Okay. Thank you. All right. So it's great. It's a very informal type of talk. It's very nice. So today I'm going to talk about how our lab is making our effort towards identifying all the receptors matching with all the odorants in the world. Clearly not there yet, but so hopefully I'll get to this point that to describe our new effort to identify most, if not all, of the odorant receptors activated by an odor of interest. So I start with something that's not my work. This is a work from the European country. Okay, so this dog is trained to diagnose the patients who has infected by this bacteria called C. diff. This is a devastating infection, and it basically happens in the hospital. And if you're treated by antibiotics, you kill the bacteria. But this bacteria somehow grows in this environment. So basically, chronic antibiotics treatment is causing the infection of C. diff, causing a serious condition or death. But in any case, what I want to show is the how he is very effective using the sense of smell. So this is the ward, and then there is a post-hospital. And he's trained to detect the patients with the infection, right? And then he sits down, which basically means that this guy is infected. So this is basically our imagination, how he sees the world. And then, okay, you know, okay, this is somewhat different.
No problem.
Okay, so he has no problem identifying. So clearly, this guy will be taken to the quarantine for further analysis. So that's amazing.
And it's presumably cost-effective compared to, say, taking samples from everyone and doing mass spec on them?
So if you do that, it's not only more expensive, but it takes time. Uh-huh. You basically take the sample and then culture the sample for 2 days, and then you basically investigate whether C. diff is there. Right? Mm-hmm. So this is instant. Mm-hmm. And according to that paper, he can identify almost everybody. Actually, he found more than the ones that they could confirm to be infected. For these negatives, they basically speculate they may actually have an infection, but the dog is so sensitive that you can't really detect by the conventional analysis.
He doesn't find it on non-biotic surfaces, like on tables or, you know, like with isolated bacteria in the hospital on other surfaces.
Well, okay. So the way he trained was to be trained by the bacteria itself. So in this, actually, this is a short clip of a long video. He basically could identify this a Falcon tube. In it, basically, there's a small amount of bacteria in it, and you close the tube. And then you put it somewhere like on the big field, and then he goes out, and then he finds that too.
Yeah. So is it stinky stuff? Like, can we smell it?
Apparently so.
Okay.
So it's a stinky bacteria.
The dog presumably picks it up at much lower concentration.
Yeah.
They use gloves when they close the tube, right?
I think so. Yeah. So that's good. Obviously the nose is a place to do this job, and the brain, of course. Now, so everyone knows about this, I guess, but I'll just go ahead to remind you all the basic stuff. We have the nose.
Does it work?
Yeah, it works. Good. The volatile chemicals coming into the nostril dissolve into the mucus. and binds and activate the odorant receptor proteins that are accumulated in the cilia membrane of the olfactory sensory neurons. And from there, the information goes to the olfactory bulb, to the cortical areas. Now, the olfactory sensory neurons have very interesting characteristics to make us think the logic to be very interesting. So one of the thing is this one olfactory neuron one receptor rule. Whether this is absolutely correct is not clear, but nonetheless it's in general true. Basically, each olfactory neuron choose to express one out of the hundreds of receptor genes, so that each individual receptor is marked by the identity of the receptor. Nonetheless, the odorant receptors do have common signal transduction pathways that in that odorant receptor activation will lead to the G-off, G protein activation, which causes the cyclic AMP production by adenosine cyclase 3, the adenosine cyclase. So the cyclic AMP would bind to the CNG channel that would trigger the ions coming in to initiate the polarization process.
Question?
Yes.
So there is basically a negligible amount of ions that comes in as a result of activation of cMAMIL receptor.
Well, I mean, no. I mean, you can clearly measure. So this is the initial part of it, that when you record, the majority of the ions is coming through the voltage gated channel.
But if I would somehow get rid of the voltage gated of the CNG.
So if you get
any ions coming through the receptor channel, through the receptor itself, that's the point.
No, the receptor itself doesn't pass the ions. Basically, if you knock out CNG channel or the AC3 or the G protein, you basically eliminate almost all the ability to sense.
Well, this partly comes up because we had insect talks.
I see. Good. Yeah. So the insect receptors, so it's really interesting. Insect receptors are completely different in primary structure and sequence compared to the mammalian receptors. The insect receptors are ion channels. There's some controversy whether the insect receptors can also transduce this type of cascade, but the receptors themselves are very much different. So there is no evidence, nobody basically thinks that the odorant receptor in mammals can function as ion channels.
But I mean, when it changes conformation, I guess.
Well, it changes conformation by odor binding, which is true in both insect and the mammalian
receptors. So there's some change in like
it's sort of a capacity. There could be a brief capacitive current, effectively, right? That would be a consequence of a changing structure, but that's not enough to sort of trigger sort of action potential firing or anything.
I mean, I guess that's my question: whether it's like a discrete two classes of receptors, or it's a continuum, basically. So mammalian receptors on one side and insect on the other.
Yeah,
theme, but there's,
it is not clear how much similarity in a structural level between the insect receptors and the mammalian receptors. Probably none, but there must be some general thing. So basically, this odorant receptor activation should be understood in the context of G protein coupled receptor activation, such as rhodopsin or beta 2 receptors that are very well understood, much better understood than the odorant receptors. So, which basically leads to the next one. So, the odorant receptor, mammalian odorant receptors are the G protein coupled receptors. And the G protein coupled receptors are receptors that can sense a lot of different things, light and the hormones and the small molecules to a big proteins. Okay. So you can draw this evolutionary tree. The odorant receptors are here in this one family members, but because the odorant receptors are so big here, you can't really draw. So it's over here.
From
yes.
From,
It's an open question, it's a discussion in that, right? So,
Yeah, you can ask.
It's not related. Is there any idea or in the field why there's a difference between insects and mammals and various types of receptors?
As far as I know, there's no, how can I say, good hypothesis. I mean, clearly they have evolved very differently. So from the sequence, there's no evidence they have evolved from the common ancestor in terms of the receptors themselves.
So what are the pros and cons of having a GPCR receptor versus a ionic receptor?
Okay, pros and cons. I do not see any reason why we cannot use ion channel type of receptors or the insect using G protein coupled receptor type.
I think the idea for GPCR is that it can amplify signal.
Right?
Which one? It can amplify signal because of the cascade.
Well, I mean that can be done with the ion channels too, because if you have a voltage gated channel, that would amplify the signal. So I don't think that would be the reason. I don't think there's really no real good reason why we're using different types of receptors.
I think Brian maybe has like you mentioned points about the speed, right? Speed.
Yeah, I was just about to say the speed.
Sure, the ion channels in insects is faster, right?
Okay. What's the alpha?
But then.
It's hard to do dynamic range tuning with an ion channel. I think that's the main thing, right? I mean, if the binding pocket basically has a certain affinity to it, that's going to give you, essentially lock you into about a log and a half worth of sensitivity range, unless you have something like what happens in the rhodopsin, you know, cascade and also in olfaction, where you can essentially tune how many of those molecules need to become activated in order to, you know, give rise to a significant response. So I suspect that it's really sort of more the adaptability of the system that is the primary advantage for a second messenger system, and the downside is it's a little bit slower.
How much slower would that be, that cascade?
It depends a lot, mostly on the amount of amplification. So for instance, in vision, right, rod vision is much slower than cone vision.
Cone vision is fast.
Right? Cone vision is quite fast. So. It really does depend a lot on the details of the operating conditions. I mean, there are GPCR cascade, right? Isn't the rod bipolar synapse, if I remember correctly, that's like 10 milliseconds or something, right? That's still a little bit slow by the standards of an ion channel. That's not that slow.
What about other groups like crustacea, mollusk? I mean, what system do they use?
Okay.
They're not as fast. Like a Drosophila is a very fast animal.
Okay, what I know, so Drosophila uses two different kind of receptors. One is the Doudan receptor, another is the IRs, right? The glutamate receptor type ion channels. So these are more widely used in species like lobsters, right? I don't know all other species, I should say, but my understanding is that the insect type of receptors are fairly restricted in the insect type of species, whereas the IRs are more widely distributed.
They're still anotropic.
Oh yeah, they're still anotropic.
It's still kind of
yeah.
It's
but they're evolutionally set independent. Okay, good. So of course this combinatorial order coding is around. Basically each orderon would activate a specific combination of the receptors, but this scheme is very much simplified because there aren't four receptors, there are hundreds of receptors. So it'll be very nice to know how many and which receptors are activated by a given order at a given concentration. That will lead to ask how does each odor receptor contribute odor perception, right? So that's good to know. The field has suffered tremendously because of the difficulty to functionally express odor receptors in heterologous cells. Of course, there are a few receptors that could be expressed and identified, such as I7 or G and a few other things. But the vast majority of the receptors, it was very difficult to use a cell-based system to functionally assess. So many years ago in our lab, we basically conducted a screening to identify a helper molecule for the odorant receptors to be expressed on the cell surface. And then we identified these RTP family members. There are two RTP1 or 1S and RTP2. They're expressed in olfactory sensory neurons. And when we express these RTP1S, for example, with an odorant receptor, you can express the receptor molecule on the cell surface. So which is a basis for our heterologous cell system to match each odorant receptor with tested odorant. In this system, we basically express odorant receptor and accessory molecule, these helper molecule, as well as the reporter gene, the luciferase reporter gene, driven by the cyclic AMP response element, in a cell, so that this given cell, when the odorant is activating the odorant receptor, that will be converted into the luciferase reporter gene expression, so that we can create this type of dose response curve, and then we can calculate the EC50, which is the concentration that generate the 50% of the maximum response.
This is a human kidney cells or something like that.
Yeah, so this cell is derived from the HEK293 cells, which is the human embryonic kidney cells.
Okay, is the assumption that the amount of this expression is related to the spiking of this factory sensor neuron?
To some extent, yes. I'll have some data, but not the spiking. But I have the data that in vitro response has a good correlation with the in vivo data.
But it's not the amount of expression, it's the luciferase.
It's a luciferase, yes.
Yeah, but I think this cell, I was going to say, maybe you'll get to this, you don't want to be sure that that's no. But if the receptors, the whole signaling pathway is rapidly adapting, you really are in trouble, right? Because this is kind of more steady state. Mm-hmm. You need to sustain the image. So anyway,
because
you can just invariably map it out.
Can you just remind here how you deliver the receptor itself?
So the receptors are expressed. So basically we're gonna have a plasmid DNA encoding receptor, right? And we mix the plasmid encoding different things, the receptors and accessory proteins and the luciferase. Then we basically mix them and then transfect into cells. Basically, we will make these kidney-derived cells to express all the other things. And then we basically wait for one day, and then we're gonna mix the odor with the culture medium essentially, and then we basically stimulate the cells with that solution.
I think you should have Alexei's transformation complete by just making him come and clone in a lab for a few days.
Sorry, I think I missed the how do you so the when the RTP binds to the OR?
Yes, that physically
that,
binds.
That gets the cream. What gets the
cream? No, okay. Okay, so I skipped a lot of things. So I'm sorry. So odorant receptor. So the membrane proteins are produced in the ER. Right, and then transported to the Golgi and to the plasma membrane. Odorant receptors, when expressed alone, would be trapped at the ER and are not transported to the Golgi to the membrane. In the presence of RTP, we don't know the exact mechanism. Somehow they interact with each other, and these complexes are transported to the Golgi to the membrane. That's what RTP is doing. Now, when the odorant receptor is on the surface and activated by an odor, then it will couple with the G protein, right? And then that would activate the cyclic adenine cyclase to produce cyclic AMP, okay? And the cyclic AMP then would activate this protein kinase A. That would phosphorylate this transcription factor called the CREB. And that activated CREB will then bind to the CRE to induce luciferase reporter.
Okay.
So that's a long cascade.
Okay, so what you're seeing there is just the luciferase signal,
yes.
The blue line there.
Exactly. So basically, each well in a cell culture dish will get a fixed concentration of the odor, right? So that's how we make this dose response curve.
Okay.
So basically, this is a more standard pharmacology type of experiment.
So it's plasmids that get integrated into the DNA, or they just flow around in the cells?
The DNA should stay in the cell for a couple of days. So when we test, the DNA should be there, but I don't think it's DNA.
I see, but you could have different numbers of plasmids in all the cells.
That's correct. We can mix different types of plasmid, and then we basically expect...
No, but even in the transaction process, it's not clear if you have one or five plasmids in one cell, right?
Yes, we basically mix five different things in one cell. I mean, I don't know how many.
No, it's not like copy number.
Oh, okay. Okay, we don't know really. I mean, how many plasmids are there? How many mRNAs are made? We don't know how much proteins made. We can't count. All we know is that the plasmid transfection would make the receptor to be expressed on the cell surface, so that we can measure. So we don't have that. Quantitative aspect of it. But in any case, so using this type of method, a few years ago, we could generate this big, relatively big matrix in which the you get about 60 receptors against 60 odorant. So as you can see. You see the combinatorial nature of the coding in that a specific combination of the receptor is activated by a given odor. Now you can see that some receptors can be activated by many many odorants that are structurally quite different, whereas the most of the receptors are relatively narrowly tuned to a few chemicals among the chemicals we tested. Okay. So,
I mean, there are studies in vivo that show that I think, like, if you pick a random subset of chemicals that are in there, like 4%, I think 4% of a given glomerulus will be activated by 4%.
Yes, so there are a lot of studies at the glomerular level or the single olfactory neuron level, not knowing the receptor, that how many chemicals would activate a single type of receptor, and so on, at what concentration and so on. I think the matrix that we're generating is unique in the sense that we can assign to a specific receptor sequence. All right. So the power of this type of study was
One of the things you all the reports are PEC-15, mm-hmm. So do you have a sense of the sort of the cooperativity, I don't know, the Hill coefficient or something for all of these things? Is it widely ranging or is it pretty similar across the field?
Okay, it depends on the receptor. Yes, the dose response, the shape of the dose response varies, and
one order of magnitude, because it seems like, you know, theoretically thinking about lots of these sigmoids but not too much Hill coefficient variability is sort of mm-hmm. easier for at least in my head mm-hmm, than mm-hmm. if you really have one that is very large dynamic range. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I would say they're quite different from receptor.
You can actually figure it out from just recording receptors. You don't need to know this. It's a statistical question, right? And I think like in receptors. It was studied extensively, and I couldn't give you a reference off my head, but it varies from 0.6 to 3 in Hill coefficient.
I see.
So that's like roughly a little.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So.
And you guys are remind me, how close in your data set, what's the relationship between the sort of the evolutionary distance between the receptors and how different their functional properties are?
Okay. So. Actually, I want to hold that till the second part of my talk, because I have that
Great.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So, okay. So this heterologous cell system served as a powerful tool to investigate how the receptor polymorphisms in human population affects the function and perception. So this is the first example of that, which is the, so this chemical is called androstenone. If I need, okay, I wish I could bring that chemical, but in any case, it's very interesting. I actually recommend you to use in your classroom. You know, students are very excited about this. Okay, but in any case, so the bottom line is that if you smell, probably half of you will not be able to smell, others will be able to smell, and for those who can smell, you may describe it as really disgusting, or you may feel it's kind of okay. That's right. So that's interesting. But in any case, what we did was that we screened for the receptor in the human genome, basically human odorant receptor. So we basically cloned 300 receptors and tested which receptor was activated by this, and identified this receptor called OR74. And the interesting thing is that this receptor has two major isoforms, or what can I say, not isoform, two major variants, the genetic variants, called RT and the WM. Basically, there are two amino acid changes. They are completely linked, and one would be activated by this chemical, others are not. Okay, and so with the collaboration with the Leslie Boschall and other groups, actually, to show that this polymorphisms would actually be a very good predictor for the subject whether he or she can smell this chemical or not. So basically, if you have two functional copies on the genome, you're very much likely to be able to smell it. This is the intensity, this is the y-axis. Whereas if you have only one functional copy or no copies, then you're much less likely to be able to smell this. Okay. So it's not just the intensity, but how you describe the chemical. If you have two functional copies and you can smell it, you are more likely to describe this chemical as sickening, heavy, putrid, foul, or bitter. Whereas if you're the one, for the lucky one, who has only one copy but you can smell, then you're more likely to describe it as vanilla, sweet, or rotten fruit.
Is this the one where there's a sex difference?
We actually looked into it. There was no, what can I say, statistically significant differences. So there are some papers showing that females are more sensitive than males. We did find the same trend, but in our cohort, it was not significant. So I don't know, you know, the way we're testing is maybe a little bit different. So the thing is that the males may produce the this androstenone because this is related to testosterone, basically. So it shares the testosterone biogenesis pathway. So presumably males would produce a lot more androstenone, right? So that may make the male-female differences.
So there was a, I don't know the reference, but there was a behavioral study painting this into bathroom stalls in a men's room and with a closed circuit camera. And what they found is that men couldn't, they couldn't detect it. Some men couldn't detect it, but they still avoided those stalls.
Okay.
So is it possible?
So that's actually very interesting. I'm actually not talking about it, but we do, what can I say? We are studying whether this conscious smell or an unconscious smell can be separated by genetics. So this is the study that is not androstenone, but androstedieino, which is very similar, but has more paper, I guess, Noam Sobel has published about this, right? So that may affect the unconscious part of function. And our data basically tells that at this point, this receptor may not be influencing the unconscious odor perception, but there may be other receptor that effects that has some impact on the unconscious part of the response.
In both pictures that you can train people to recognize it, if you shock them with the, I don't remember which odor it was exactly, but he gave a shock to humans, and he showed that they can learn to recognize the odor,
Oh, okay, so if you make them trying very hard to learn it.
But I have another question.
Yeah.
How do you explain the data? If there's only one receptor which responds to this odor, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have two copies, you think it's bad. Mm-hmm. If you have one copy, you think it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. One copy versus two copies means to me that it's just responding less, right? Mm-hmm. So if you give like the same odor but lower the concentration, would you smell it as good as vanilla?
So in our experiment, basically they're smelling a very high concentration. It's a very big molecule, very low volatility, right? So I'm not sure how to make it even stronger, but maybe that's true. I mean, if you have one copy, you would think that some of the neurons expressing these receptors would respond to the chemical, right? So maybe there is a threshold.
So the prediction of this result is that if you have to take someone with two copies, give him a very low concentration, you would think it's vanilla, right? That's
true. I mean, if it applies to all the other receptors, sure.
That's something that happens, or you don't?
I don't think so, but I don't have. So this is the only one that I can tell that has a very clear
because if it's
copy.
If it's not happening, it tells us something about the system, right?
Yeah. In some other cases, basically the two copies and one copies are similar, and no copies is different, right? So that's more understandable. That's more, what can I say, recessive trait genetics, right? Yes.
So what's the rule for expression in a heterozygote? Are both expressed equally, and are both expressed on the cell membrane?
Okay,
equally?
We do not know about that. In fact, we don't really know the expression of this receptor at the cell level. It's incredibly difficult for us to do any meaningful experiment using human nose. We know that this receptor is expressed in the olfactory epithelium by others.
Both of them are.
No, but we do not have that resolution.
Okay.
Well, and in other mammalian odor receptors in the mouse where it's been studied, in fact, each cell will pick either the maternal copy or the paternal copy. So the naive prediction here is that half of the cells are expressing RT and half of the cells are expressing WM, which makes the result even more surprising.
So in the epithelium, it's either or.
Correct.
Right,
yep.
Okay.
Yep. Either or, but what we don't know is this. So this WM in the heterologous system doesn't respond to this, right? So in the mouse study, it is shown that neurons, the olfactory neurons, when choosing a receptor out of hundreds of candidates, if it happens to choose a non-functional receptor, then it will switch to another receptor. Now, if the system, in the developing olfactory neuron, decides this type of WM type of variant to be non-functional or not, we don't know actually. So it's not a pseudogene. There's no stop codon. There's no obvious defect, but it just doesn't respond to the tested order, right? So in that case, what happens to the nose is not clear. And I think it's an interesting question to ask. Okay, but it also tells me that at least in this case and some other case I'm talking about, that there are small number of receptors for a given chemical that has an impact, which basically means that for odor perception for these chemicals, there are only small number of receptors that are truly important, right? So these include, I don't know this is the current list, but nearly current. There are five receptors that are shown to be linked with odor perception, which include the isobaric acid that Doron Lancet probably talked about, as well as the beta ionon. This is a very strong link between the odor perception and the receptor, and TenG4 that Joe Menland, when he was in my lab, had done. There are other things that are linked with the odorant receptor cluster, but it's hard to resolve the genetic link into a single receptor. An interesting examples are these, for example, these, you know, if you eat asparagus and then and you pee, you may smell something very weird. That trait is genetic, and it's on the odorant receptor cluster. So the more likely one receptor or maybe a few receptors are responsible. Another is the cilantro. Some people hate cilantro. That's because they feel that the flavor of the cilantro is really awful. But in any case, that's also a trait that's linked with the odorant receptor cluster. Good. So it is not really clear how much odorant receptor genetics can explain variability in odor perception, but we can say that at the receptor level, we are all different in terms of function of the receptors. Doran probably talked about the sequences, sequence level different, but even more pronounced, I would say, at the functional level, we can basically prove that at the functional level, we are about 30% different if you compare to random individuals in the Southern Genome Project. We can estimate that 70% of the receptors are probably functionally equivalent, but 30% is different.
So here, just to make sure I understand how to read this. Perhaps so along the X.
Okay.
The
so this is the different subject, and these are different receptors. Okay, and we basically took the reference genome sequence. Every person has two copies of each of these receptors, right? And if you have two copies of receptors that are functionally equivalent to the reference version of the receptor, that's green. And if you have one copy that's the same, one copy different, that's like this, half green, half red. And if you have two copies that are functionally different, then it's just red. So you see that. And the bottom line is that each subject has this a unique combination of green and red and half green, half red squares, which basically means that everyone is different functionally.
But functional difference, you measure it by?
By the heterologous cell assays.
And how different do they have to be classified as function different in this? I mean, this is a yes-no classification, right?
Yes-no classification. We basically compared two different dose-response curves. If it's statistically different, then that's different.
So even if it's a threefold difference in sensitivity, you would call that function different
if that's reproducible, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So. So this is a new part to really investigate which receptors are activated in vivo when smelling. All right. So okay. So this is the work that grad student Yue Jiang has done, basically to use this phosphorylated ribosome immunoprecipitation combined with RNA-seq to identify the receptor. So I'll explain what it means. It may not be obvious. So many of the audience know about CFOS. You know, people use it to see which neurons were recently activated. So that's because the CFOS gene induction is induced by a variety of neuronal activation. Similar thing would happen to the phosphorylation of this ribosomal subunit called S6, which we call PS6, phospho-S6, okay? And so basically, we take advantage of this phospho-S6 to monitor the which neurons or which odorant receptors are activated by tested order, right? So the experiment is quite simple. We take the a mouse and put it in a box. Actually, it's not proportionally. And then we're gonna take an order. You know, this case as the phenol. Just put it on the filter paper, and then put it in a box, and then just have them smell for 1 hour and sacrifice, and then cut the sections, and then see the phosphor S6 induction by the immunostain. Okay, so this is the green signal is the phosphor S6 signal. So if you compare these two, you can tell that there's no green signal here, and then there are a lot of green signals. Okay, so which basically means that these neurons, these are all olfactory neurons. These olfactory neurons were activated, and which can be visualized by this anti-phosphor S6. Okay, and this red signal marks the a known acetophenone odor receptor. So that acetophenone is the odor we used, right? So if you see A, all the M72 expressing neurons are also green, basically telling that this marks the active neurons. So I'm showing a few more follow-ups to confirm this. All right.
And there's certainly less green than some of the fellow neurons, right? So that suggests
that's correct. So that will be quantitative. I don't know how quantitative they are, but it is true that M72, this receptor, is not the best receptor for the tested chemical, and that will be more evident in the later experiment. Okay. But for now, I should say this is one of the few receptors that people know to be responding in vivo and then have used in different contexts. That's why we're using it. Okay. All right. Any case. So when we did a similar experiment with a panel of odors, including acetophenone, which I was showing, the known M72 ligands always activate majority of the neurons expressing M72. Okay, this activation is basically defined by PS6 staining, whereas the all the control odors, which are not activating M72, we know, did not show any colocalization with PS6. Okay, so that's good, at least. So this is another type of control experiment in which we stimulate the mouse with acetophenone and then see the colocalization with a panel of receptors that are known to be activated by various different chemicals. Okay, so M72 to acetophenone, right? And this receptor is known to be activated by isobaric acid, this one for eugenol, this one I7, probably many of you know, to be activated by, in this case, heptanol, the mouse version, and this receptor is activated by muscon. The bottom line is that only the acetophenone activated neurons colocalize with this receptor, but not with all the other receptors, which can be quantified. Okay, so the signal intensity is more in the M72 neurons compared to all the other neurons. Okay. So we can do that with all the panels of the chemicals, and it's a lot of data, but the bottom line is that only the right combination you see more activation. Okay, so
this is all done by in situ hybridization.
That's correct. This is the in situ hybridization in combination with phosphor S6. Yes.
And you're just quantifying the signal intensity is based on the level of fluorescence.
That's correct. That's correct. Okay. Good. So that's all good. So now we can ask, so this is the phosphor S6. So we want to know.
To make the variability, the other individual is individual cell.
That's
the
correct.
Range of the thing is cross animals. In other words, if you just take many cells from one animal, mm-hmm. do you see less variability?
No, we do see variability within the animal. We do see variability between
the
animals.
It's not different levels of activation in different animals.
That's correct.
You cannot distinguish different alleles of the same receptor.
Different what?
Alleles of the same receptor.
We cannot distinguish in this experiment.
This is mice, though.
This is mice. We're using inbred, so we're not asking that question. We can ask that question using different strains of mice, in theory, but we're not asking that in this work. Yes?
Could you see inhibition with this technique?
In theory, it's possible. We don't really see much in our tested chemicals, but I'll get to that later. But I think if there is an inhibition, we should be able to see differences. But that may require more samples because the background level is rather low. So in order for us to see inhibition, you know, the baseline PS6 level will become even lower, which is difficult to see. If you're talking the inhibition about the what can I say, auto masking, for example, this should be able to detect it.
So if you use different, I mean, we talked about adaptation last week, so if you use different time courses where you activate the odor and deactivate, you see different activation of your PS6.
Okay, so this method is really bad in terms of knowing the time course, because what we do is that we stimulate the animal, wait for 1 hour, and we sacrifice, right?
I understand, but right? You could still, the total activation, I mean, it's like an integrative signal, right? The CFOS at least, I don't know.
Yes, this is more like an integrative
signal. So if you have adaptation, you might only integrate like the first 10 minutes of the exposure, and then you're gone, but if you activate, if you take a time,
you
might actually integrate more and get a better signal. That's what the question.
Sure, I mean, we have not done that, but yes, that the at least, in principle, you should be able to ask that question if you have auto stimulation for some time and then no odor for the next hour and then you do more and so on. Yes, you should be able to integrate the activation. Okay, good. Okay, so the idea is that we're gonna basically take the tissue. And then we're gonna immunoprecipitate the phospho S6 ribosome. Basically, the ribosome, as you know, is a place where the protein is produced. Therefore, they are associated with mRNA, so that we can selectively precipitate RNAs coming from the active olfactory sensory neurons, right? So when we sequence the RNA and compare with the samples coming from the animal that are auto-induced versus not induced, we should be able to identify the receptors. Okay, so that's the logic. That's the data. Okay, so the y-axis is the RNA, the RNA-seq result, basically the RNA abundance coming from the stimulated animal, and the x-axis is the unstimulated. So as you can expect, vast majority of the genes are within this 45 degree line, no difference. But the odorant receptors, even though the majority of them are again the 45 degree line, close to that, some of the receptors are here, which basically are enriched by the odor stimulation. Okay, and I want to point out two things: CFOS and EGR1, two immediate early genes are also within the enriched group. Even though CFOS, EGR1 are, what can I say, really bad marker for the olfactory sensory neuron activation, when you're using the histology, you can still see some enrichment in this preparation. Okay. So this is another visualization, just focusing on the odorant receptors. Okay. So these are the ones that are significantly enriched by acetophenone. Okay, and this is the another way to visualize.
This is only plotting odor receptors.
This is only plotting odor receptors.
And these are all for just acetophenone alone. Right?
That's correct. That's
a lot of receptors.
There are a lot of receptors that are activated.
Can we take back all those old papers?
Right. Yeah.
No. It depends on the concentration, right?
Of course. Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a high concentration. You know, this is 10 microliter of 100%. You know, put in on a field.
How many receptors?
So in this one, you know, basically, you know, depending on the threshold, but 75 receptors, right? Out of which is actually not.
That's not a crazy.
No, that's not crazy. If you look at the you know, for example, the olfactory bulb imaging with very high concentration of odor, you do see like, you know, 10% of the growth.
You see plenty of glomeruli even at low concentration of acetophenone, which is why I'm annoyed personally. It's called an M71 receptor.
Right. If you want to stimulate, you know, the point that M71 or M72 is activated, a lot of other receptors are activated. You know that, right? Yeah. Good. So this is the another way to visualize the volcano plot. The volcano plot usually goes like this, but You only see this side, which is basically the active side. That's why if you see the inhibition, you should see significant ones here. If you see that, then that I would call an inhibition. But for acetophenone, at least, we don't see that.
You would need to run like false discovery rate correction on this one.
Yes, this is false discovery rate correction.
So it's a Q value?
I cannot say that, but yes, I guess basically this is false discovery rate correction. According to, okay, so the package we're using is called the HR, whatever that is. Okay, I have that level of understanding, so I cannot answer that question. My student can't answer that question. I have a lot of slides that I have only the sufficient understanding to what can I say, to present, but not to answer the questions. I really need to know. I want to talk to you to understand that. Okay, good. So this is a lower concentration, all right? So this is 1%. Okay, so it's more realistic concentration, I guess. In this case, then depending on the p-value, it's up to 25 receptors to be activated. Okay. So you can tell, for example, okay, so this receptor must be a fantastic receptor, right? So, and this is like separate from all the other receptors. So maybe that's a good receptor to follow up if you're interested in like the best acetophenone receptor ever.
Did that one show up at the top of your higher concentrations?
Yes, that's correct. It's not the best one, I believe. Okay.
But it's near the top.
Yeah. I can probably tell you. Okay. So the one that's the best. Okay. So this is the best one. So it's probably the fifth best one. Higher concentration.
And that could be that adaptation phenomenon that we were discussing earlier.
It could be, yes. So it is true. It's not the best receptor at low concentration is not always the best receptor at higher concentration, even though it's among the best. Yeah. It's probably because of the saturation. Imagine, I mean, this receptor is already saturated at this concentration. All the other receptors are not saturated.
I mean, essentially, the signal that you're going to read out is a consequence of the sort of total integrated phospho-S6 activation of the cell, and it's really since the receptor may adapt so quickly that, in fact, it gets less integrated activity than one that doesn't adapt so quickly.
That's actually true. We have done a series of the this in situ and phospho-S6 comparison in different concentrations. Some receptors, the best receptors, we get more signals at lower concentration than higher concentration. Yeah. Okay, good. So this is basically just plotting the p-value of the lower concentration versus higher concentration just to see the correlation, right? So as you can see, many or vast majority of the receptors that are significant at low concentration is also significant at higher concentration, which you might expect. But there are receptors that are only significant at a higher concentration. Okay, so these are probably lower affinity receptors. So that's good. All right.
Have you done an intermediate concept? I mean, obviously, one potential interpretation as a skeptical scientist that you are is those are just, you know, there's something weird happening, right? So have you done a 10% concentration?
No, we have not done the 10% concentration in this experiment. We have done, basically, we have done the RNA-seq. We have done the histology, basically, this in situ hybridization with the phospho-6 at various concentrations. I don't think there's no weirdness about this. Okay, good. So now we're interested in really knowing. So now we feel we're in a position to really systematically compare the in vitro response that we have been working on versus what's happening in vivo. Okay. So what we did was this. Okay. So this is the in vitro scheme, and we basically took about 500 receptors. So we tested all of them, the ones that are squared, in vitro, and see which ones respond to acetophenone, and then and we want to know whether the in vivo response correlates with in vitro response and vice versa, right? So maybe it's not necessary for this audience, but in any case, we use this ROC curve. Essentially, if in vivo experiment, in vitro experiment are perfectly matched each other, then we will see the ROC curve like this, and the area on the curve will be 1. If they are completely random, then the ROC curve will be like this, and area on the curve will be 0.5. Okay. So when we did this with this tested order, so what we found was that when we grouped the in vivo enriched receptors versus unenriched receptors, we find a clear difference in terms of the in vitro activation at 30 micromolar, 300 micromolar as a group. Okay, and if we run this ROC curve, that's clearly better than random, worse than perfect. This number for me it seems to be quite good. We can do a different direction, whether the in vitro activated receptors are in vivo enriched. Again, as a group, we see the clear difference between these two groups, and the AUC is in better. But the bottom line is that in vitro and in vivo response correlated, not perfect, probably good about 70% of the time. So for this, I just came up with the different possibilities how to explain differences. Maybe this is not all, but any case, I basically listed them. The receptors that are enriched in vivo but not activated in vitro. Right. The interesting possibilities are like number one, okay, the biotransformation of odorants in nasal mucus. For example, if an odorant is converted to another odor in the mucus and then activated, then of course the in vivo and in vitro responses will not match. Okay, so that's reported at least in some indirect way, but now we have what can I say, candidates, receptors to investigate. Number two, alternative signal transduction pathway. So non-cyclic AMP mediated pathway has been proposed and at least seems to have some roles in olfactory neurons. And if some receptors use this alternative pathway as a major pathway, then our in vitro assay solely relies on the cyclic AMP may not work. Number three, co-expression of multiple odorant receptors in one olfactory sensory neurons. If that's the case, then of course our enrichment process will purify, enrich the receptors that are not functioning in the cortex. Okay. Number four, poor odorant receptor functional expression in vitro. As I said, you know, in the presence of the accessory proteins, we improved the in vitro expression, but we also know it's not perfect. Some receptors we still have hard time getting expressed functionally, so that's clearly a possibility. Others are more technical things. How do we define the in vitro activation? Or how do we define an odorant receptor gene when we do the receptors? So that's the odorant receptor annotation is actually a big problem. Until very recently, basically the odorant receptors on the genome is defined by the open reading frame, where we know that 3' UTR is quite significant. Darren Logan has published the odorant receptor annotation, including the untranslated regions more recently. So that's great, but we also, when we use them, okay, what's the problem? We found that some receptors have issues like, okay, for example, M72 were not defined in this new definition. Mm-hmm. So we need to fix this. And so we are doing that. And then some statistical issues.
So in yes. Like when you do RNA-seq, what do you use for RT instead?
We use oligo-DT, and then we do the reverse transcriptase.
Then the 3' prime.
So it is 3' prime enriched. Yes, that's correct. Because we use oligo-DT, and because we have to amplify the RNA, with our experiment, we get about what? Nanogram of RNA, maybe 10 nanogram of RNA, which is good enough to make libraries, but we need to amplify it.
So, but there would be, I mean, obviously the prime will unbind exponentially, right?
So we know that with the inclusion of the 3' UTR, we can increase the sensitivity. We get we can double the number of the sequence reads to map to the odorant receptor. So that would generate a lot more sensitive reads. On the other hand, as I said, the current definition has an issue, so we need to first correct all the problems and then use them.
And for the primers, for like quantification, what do you use for the primers?
So basically what we do is, okay, so if I have to. So basically it is similar to how we amplify cDNA from single cells, but what we do is we make cDNA. We basically tail the end of the cDNA with aids, and then we basically that's going to make all the cDNA to have T's and aids, so that we can use the oligo-DT type of primer to amplify the entire product. So we do that for small number of PCR steps to amplify the DNA, so that we can use that as a template to make an Illumina library, which generates a lot of sequence.
So maybe for this audience, it might be useful to know why is this a concern, Alex? Maybe we can get to what's the point of this bit? You won't identify this properly, or
no? I mean,
you won't get all
some receptors that are missing. So you know, at least
so the worry is that you won't get all of them. You'll miss some, but you won't misidentify any, presumably.
So that's actually a very nice point, because imagine a receptor that have a very long 3' UTR, like 3 kb or something. Then I'm going to miss it because I cannot amplify it.
You're not using OR-specific primers. You're just using...
No, we're not using OR-specific primers. We basically amplify the entire cDNA and then sequence. So OR-specific sequence or enrichment will be interesting, and I think it will make it more efficient down the road. It is just that basically nobody has established that yet. Okay. Did I talk about everything? Okay, so the other way around, all right? So activated in vitro but not enriched in vivo. Okay. So one obvious thing is that if odor receptor is activated by mouse odor and it's constantly activated or desensitized, then we may not be able to identify that in vivo. Again, the 3' UTR thing, okay, and the low. So this basically has a limitation in terms of that. What can I say? Some receptors are not chosen very frequently. For the ones that are less chosen, we need to sequence more. And we know that our sequencing depth is not enough to capture all the receptors. We can probably correctly identify about 70% of the receptors at this point. So the rest of 30%, we have small number of reads. Therefore, we are not very confident identifying them as positive or negative. Okay.
So the first point is that ORs that are being sort of tolerably activated may be desensitized. Is that what you
mean? Yeah. So that's a possibility. I don't know how that will translate into the phospho-S6 stain. So at this point, because I don't know that, that's one possibility we don't. Right, that's the same, okay. Yeah, so we know odor stimulation will not phosphorylate the S6 at equal level to all the neurons express the same receptor. So that variation, is it coming from some local concentration of odor, developmental stage, or some other things? We don't know. So that's an interesting question, but we have not characterized that. Okay. So these are the things that I think about. If you come up with other possibilities, let me know.
Do you think the biotransformation is also potentially a factor in the second list, or is that? Basically, your thinking is that it might give you a signal in vivo because it's making something new that gets detected, but you don't think the biotransformation is so fast that it essentially completely gets rid of something.
That's perfectly possibility. I don't know.
Right.
It's a say, you know, right. Yep. It's a possibility. If that example, if there is such an example, I'll be very much interested in.
Yeah, right.
Right. So if we increase the number of the chemicals, if you identify an example in which none of the in vivo enriched ones are activated in vitro and so on, then I'll be very interested in pursuing.
Right. Interesting. Yes.
So
the
multiple
we have is a good way of
doing that. Yeah. Okay. Good. So, nonetheless, all right. So now we have in vivo and in vitro data. So we identified 48 receptors that are activated in vivo and then activated in vitro. So we feel that these receptors would represent that's the dopamine receptor with high confidence, right? So now I guess.
Are those different curves? Are those different odorants?
So these are all dose response curves in vitro. Okay. Uh-huh. So you can't see it, but that's fine. Basically, they're just showing that they're all activated.
So each panel has multiple genes, and that's how you're getting 48. So you're all 48 of those are.
Yeah, these are all 48, I believe.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. It's just that I can't, you know, make a big panel with 48 dose responses,
so you can't see it.
And I can't present 48 different dose responses, so it's just a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any case, so this is the sequence diversity. It's actually quite striking because this is the phylogenetic tree. As you know, this is class 1, that's class 2. So all of the histamine receptors falls to class 2. But the bottom line is that the sequence variability is massive. The receptors as a group will belong to probably 20 or so different subfamilies. And you do see some clusters, okay, here or here, similar receptors respond to this, you know. But this is far from the rule. Many of the receptors are basically standing alone. The very similar receptors respond to only one of them respond to acetophenone. So these, okay, these gray ones are the ones that we think, okay, we have high confidence not to be acetophenone receptors. So these receptors did not respond in vitro and they were not activated in vivo, okay?
This is across the entire protein, so exactly. You focus just on like the 729 domain.
So I will get into that.
So are these clusters, are they functional? Are they functionally similar? Are the receptors that are in the clusters?
Okay, so that's the question I'm asking, right? That's the question I'm asking. So we're only looking at the function in terms of the acetophenone response.
Right, right.
But
there was definitely variation in your groups, right?
Yeah. So these are basically
really
all.
Awesome and...
Oh, sure. In terms of that, yes. So basically, I'm basically showing that the red one to be activated by lower concentration of acetophenone. The orange one is only activated by higher concentration. Okay, so that shows the degree.
So, but you said, like, for instance, like the ones that, like, there was that one that was like super well activated at 1%.
Yeah.
And then when you went to the higher, like, that one was in a group of five that were really well. Is that group of five representing?
I do not know where that receptor is.
Basically, she just wants the affinity of each of the points, right?
So I don't know about that receptor, but you can see that you know there's a red receptor here, but then none of the ones similar to that are orange, right? So that's just isolated case. Okay, so as I said that they're all very diverse receptors, but we can still identify individual residues that are relatively well conserved among acetophenone receptors than random receptors. Okay, so that's how we did. Basically, we aligned all the receptors that are we think to be acetophenone receptors and we think not to be acetophenone receptors, and run relatively simple, I guess, measurement to basically mark the ones that are conserved among acetophenone receptors, the random, okay, and these purple ones are residues that are conserved in all the other receptors. So basically, have the threshold of 90%. As you can imagine, these are red and orange, and the purple ones are completely different set. And you can see they're very much widely distributed in different places. Okay, we're not saying that these individual residues are important for acetophenone responses, right? Because there are a few things. We think that at least some of them must be very important in acetophenone response, but not all of them. That's because some of the, what can I say? These conservation can be realized because of the genetic linkage, not just because they're all the same string, right? For a given receptor, so it is entirely conceivable that, for example, this conservation is nothing to do with the receptor response, but this happens to be always linked to this, which is very important. Things like that. Okay. But in any case, it is good to have that information. This information that there are some conserved residues among the responding receptors, which basically makes us think that we can probably construct a model to predict whether a given receptor gene sequence is an acetophenone receptor or not, right? So what we did, or actually my student did, and I only merely followed what he did, was he basically constructed a model to predict whether a given primary sequence is of odorant receptor is an acetophenone receptor or not. The first thing is I want to say, okay, so before that, okay, so we did the first the tenfold cross validation, which basically means this. So we have these 48 acetophenone receptors and 350 known acetophenone receptors, and we use that to construct models. And when we use the and we basically use the 90% of the data set to train, and then tested with the 10% of the rest, and we did that for 100 times or something. So that's tenfold cross validation, right? So when we use the similarity, basically overall similarity of two different receptors, then the predictability is almost nothing, right? As you might guess from this data, but it's striking to know that similarity doesn't tell you anything. On the other hand, when we construct a model two different ways, the support vector machine or this regression model, the net penalty, whatever that is, because I don't understand. But in any case, so we can construct a very good model to tell whether a given sequence is the is a acetophenone receptor or not.
Well, the bad news, you need to subtract 0.5 from it.
Exactly, yes. The 0.5 is basically the random, therefore this is almost random.
The good news is you can't need to multiply by 2 because the range of area on the curve is from minus 0.5 to plus 0.5.
Yeah.
So like on the level of, say, R squared, but it would be like 0.6.
Okay.
And it's interesting that it's right in the same ballpark as the similarity between your in vitro data and your in vivo data, too.
Tenfold cross validation means you just leave some out.
Yes. So leave 10% out.
Okay.
And then train. Yes, we did 100 times, right. And then that's how we made this. Yeah. Okay. Good. So we also did an external validation with human odorant receptor. Basically, it's really not good. I mean, not good in a way that we don't have many receptor information from human odorant receptor. We only have 27 odorant receptor information. But the bottom line is that we could validate the model with the human receptor. This is just a in vitro human odorant receptor response. All right. So in this case, similarity does a fairly good job, not significant, but fairly good job. We know that because in the previous experiment, we shown and others basically proposed that the orthologous receptors respond to the same odors than the paralogous receptors within the same species. So if we basically do this with the human versus mouse, The similarity basically means that it's approximately the same as orthology. Therefore, similarity works better within the different species. Nevertheless, our model performed better than the similarity alone prediction.
And this was the mouse model trained on, or is it the data?
We basically trained only mouse data validated in the human.
Okay.
Yes.
When you go back to the other one, so what are the features you can, why is the SMM, for example, performing so well? So did you go back and see what the features actually are?
I would like to know how to do this. Actually, we actually do not. Okay, I was asking this question to my student, and talking, and then end up, I don't understand. So I actually do want your kind, you know, if you have an expertise, that'd be great. I do want to have that.
Can you just explain, like in the human, in the other slide, you build SVM or ElasticNet based on mice, and then you use it on human data.
Human data, that's correct.
Test it. So mouse is a training set, then human is the testing set.
That's correct. Okay. So the last 10 minutes or 5 minutes maybe. okay, so that's great with Stofinol. So can we do it with other odorants? So we've been doing this. I'm just showing the second example, which is TMT. So this chemical has been used in many labs. Basically, it's an interesting chemical. It's coming from Fox. Feces, right? And people have used. Basically, mice would not like the Fox, this TMT, and then it's induced defensive response. Right, so that's an interesting example to identify receptors. So we did that. So it's again, we did a very similar approach with high concentration and the low concentrations. And we identified a set of receptors that are enriched. Many receptors at high concentration, only a few receptors at low concentration in this case. And most of the receptors, not all the receptors, responded in vitro. Okay.
Yeah, interesting. I don't see strong evidence that you've got, like, say, exactly two that stick out from the population in terms of those response. What do you think about that?
What is that, actually?
So meaning if you go back one slide,
yeah.
So you have two odor receptors to the low concentration that really do seem to stick out from the crowd, right? Mm-hmm. So the one hypothesis might be that these are vastly more sensitive than any others.
One health hypothesis, that's true.
And then if you go to the next slide.
Okay. That's true. That's okay. So even though we're all talking about the in vitro and they correlate, it's not that the in vivo sensitivity always correlate with in vitro sensitivity. They actually do correlate if we actually run the statistics. I'm not showing it. I have that slide somewhere. I can show you. So there's definitely a correlation, but it's not always linear or anything obvious. So now we have a sense of these two chemicals. Again, the TMT receptors are diverse. You know, again, they're like three here or two there or something. But then the TMT receptors are either blue or red. Okay. Very diverse types of receptors responding to this one chemical. And another thing is that this red receptors responded to acetophenone and TMT. They're very different. I don't see any similarity in terms of structure, but we did find several receptors responding to these two chemicals, right? So, you know, again, these are, at least some of them are probably very broadly tuned receptors, which are already identified in some cases. So that's the last, I guess, the data slide. Okay. So basically, we feel that this is a really nice platform to do more chemicals and then do more experiments. So we can test diverse odorants. We can test very similar odorants, for example, these enantiomer that have a mirror image structure of the same molecule. I talked about TMT, but these semiochemicals are very interesting candidates to look into which receptors. So in terms of TMT, I'm not showing. What can I say? We, as you know, the Scanos group basically showed that the TMT response is mediated by the receptors expressing the dorsal side. So we looked into that. The two receptors that are most sensitive are not expressed dorsally. Okay, and among the ones that we tested, I guess we tested 21 receptors. Five receptors are expressed dorsally.
But that's not surprising because I mean it does look like there's a difference in class one versus class two, and receptors which are dorsal are mostly class one. So
No. Almost all the class 1 receptors are dorsally expressed, but that class 1 is only 100 receptors, okay? And dorsally, there are probably about 500 receptors are expressed. So the 80% of the dorsally expressed receptors are class 2. Make sense?
Good.
It does make sense, but I mean, the class 1
receptors. He doesn't want it to make sense.
No. Class 1 receptors are definitely dorsally expressed. But for the TMT receptors, we basically think they are class 2 receptors dorsally expressed.
I see. But class 1, as I remember, I mean, from Boza's work, they form a compact cluster in dorsal.
Cluster in the dorsal. So basically, the dorsal olfactory bulb at least can be classified three places: the class 1 place, the TARS, and the class 2.
Okay.
And the class 2 dorsal is the largest area.
So it would not mean that there is an enrichment from by comparing with Sakano, it would mean that there is an enrichment amongst class 1 receptors.
No, there's no class 1 receptor we could find to be activated by TMT. And there actually Sakano's data excluded the class 1 involvement in TMT responses. Okay. So, of course, the mixture is an interesting one, including these natural orders that have a mixture of hundreds of chemicals. Are they the sum of each of the components? Probably not. So it's a good place to start asking the order masking effects and so on. And identifying these receptors would enable us to start asking, for example, the function of the best receptor, for example, right? Or the which receptors are involved in the behavioral output. So okay. Slide, I guess this is summary. Okay, so I talked about these the summary of the in vivo stuff, I guess. The odor stimulation induced phosphorylation of ribosomal protein S6. And this can be used to identify odor receptor in vivo, and that receptor activation in vivo, when compared by the activation in vitro, they are correlated well, not identical. And the one of the surprise is that the very diverse receptors can be activated by a given order. And hopefully this will serve more data for some of you to think more about how orders are encoded in the peripheral. Okay, thank you.
So, you know, speaking of theorists, one thing that I personally would find really useful is some sense of a much more gigantic panel of odors.
Okay.
100,000 odors, you know, whatever. Yeah. Very large number of odors.
You can't buy them.
But he'll give you money as well.
So I'm wondering, is there any strategy for getting a much larger panel of odorants and how they how
getting more money?
Against a smaller number of receptors, so of course the dream experiment will be that we have 1,000 receptors against whatever thousands of chemicals, and we want to know that. Our strategy will not do it unless we have a whole building to house mice. I think that type of experiment can only be done in vitro. The throughput that we do is not good enough to test thousands of odors against 1,000 receptors. That's also, you know, if I get $100 million, maybe I can do it. But that's not possible. Any case,
right?
With
imaging, right? I mean, if you were able to image.
No. You can image a large number of neurons, for example, but it is not trivial to correlate that with the receptor identity.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tim, you could certainly put an epithelium and get tens of thousands. You're going to talk about this, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about this in your case. And actually, it's a harder problem maybe to do in the Bayh olfactory system and the accessory olfactory system, but it's one that's worth talking about. For those who maybe don't know, you know, so my lab has been using these techniques where you record from a large number of unlabeled neurons, unlabeled in the sense that you as Hiro says, you have no idea what receptor gene those cells are expressing. And, you know, we found that you know, if you present a number of ligands to them, you can classify them functionally. And you have no idea if there's a one-to-one mapping between the functional class you identify and the receptor gene. In many cases, we suspect that in several cases, at least, that the, our functional classes probably comprise a couple of receptor genes that have overlapping sensitivity. It's, you know, I mean, it's, I think it's worth, you know, we should talk about the possibility of, could you use that as an intermediate step somehow to sort of tentatively identify, you know, what receptor this is likely to be, and then bridge your functional understanding of that into other chemicals or something like that. The big advantage of doing the imaging by calcium imaging is simply that you can use time as a mechanism to test many odorants on the same population of cells, basically.
But yes, I do think that large scale, you know, even, you know, the data, what can I say, will be very beneficial. So, you know, we talked about this in this last week's ideas lab thing, but I think the that will be good.
So, yes. So I think that's, you know, those broadly too, I think it's that one's responsible for TMP and C, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of makes it realize that it's very interesting that you can have, like, say, you know, 48 receptors that you say respond really well to acetaminophen, mm-hmm. right? The question is how well do they respond to acetaminophen mm-hmm. when another odor that maybe competes better
sure.
is there, mm-hmm. right?
I think
because, it'll respond because acetaminophen is right there and it happens to fit in the lock,
yeah.
you know? But, like, is it one of those things that if you put, like, I don't know how totally how the in vitro assays work, but, you know, can you drop in, like, TMT and acetaminophen together? Does it out-compete one versus the other? And there's probably not really any way to know which one's binding.
I think that's an interesting experiment. For me, it'll be, you know, be done in this in vivo setting. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you have acetaminophen, now I have acetaminophen data, we have TMT data. If we mix two of them together and we run the same experiment, then what happens? Is it just if you add two individual data, you can come up with that, or maybe not, right? If there are receptors that are activated by a component but not activated by the mixture, for example, that's a good example of antagonism of that receptor. So then that can, if that is replicated in vitro, then we can actually prove that. But I think now I think we should do the in vivo experiment first to know which receptor to mm-hmm. test in vitro.
Is there a difference in how different ORs respond to, like, a temporal pattern?
So again, this temporal, okay, this experiment doesn't tell you. I mean, both the luciferase assay and the PS6 has a very bad temporal resolution, mm-hmm. and I believe there's some subtle difference in temporal activation. Clearly, I mean, for example, when the odor plume comes and then dissolve into the mucus, probably the highest affinity receptor will start responding first, probably, you know, I don't know, nanosecond or millisecond earlier than the other receptor, and that could be important, right?
But this
experiment doesn't tell us.
So
I guess the way to go probably from this is that now we have a list of the receptors that are good and not so good. In order for us to test that, we have to label them, mm-hmm. and then we can compare. Mm-hmm. But without that, that tool, it's hard, I imagine. Yeah.
Just first a comment. It's just beautiful work, and I think it's really a very, very important breakthrough. One of the things that I was surprised about was to not get anything that seems to look like a binding pocket or anything. Right. Were you surprised by that?
No, I'm not saying we didn't find anything. Okay, so in terms of binding pocket, the field has a big problem that we don't have the structure of the receptor.
Yeah. Right?
So we use other GPCRs as template, which is probably 20% identical. So we don't know the accuracy ultimately. We do use them, and we do you know, publish a number of structure function type of studies, which is at least consistent with the model. But ultimately, without knowing the structure of the receptors, we really don't know. So what I would say for this is that because the diverse receptors respond to one chemical, I don't really feel that there should be one binding pocket for the same chemical, right? There must be some. But if we have, let's say, 48 receptors, can we classify them into maybe several? And that's an interesting question. And that can be modeled, I believe, if we believe the current models.
And certainly in your dendrogram, you know, there were clusters of, you know, closely related receptors that had a fairly large number of ones. So that it does seem that sort of progressing further along that direction may well suffice.
So for example, yes, I guess that actually linked to this question, what can we say from the modeling, the support vector machine, for example. If we can tell, for example, okay, this model actually think that the acetylcholine receptors can be classified into three groups, then maybe we can say that these three groups have different binding mode, right? Then that'll be interesting. But, yes.
So is TMT or are there other odors that are encoded both by vomer nasal and main olfactory, and can you compare the structure of the receptors? No way.
No, the structure, I mean, the primary structures are completely different.
Right, yeah, right.
But yes, I guess the if we know the list of the receptors for the shared ligand in the vomer nasal organ and the olfactory epithelium, then sure, I mean, we should be able to start comparing them. Right now, you know, both the odorant receptors and the vomer nasal receptors, we have very little in terms of which receptors are responding. I mean, this is one good start. In terms of the vomer nasal, of course, Catherine Dirac has done this EGR1 thing.
But like TMT,
But I'm sure that there are chemicals that can activate the vomer nasal organ and the olfactory.
When we looked, it's really hard to find much overlap. I think the steroids are actually the best candidate. So we tried androsterone and haven't seen anything there.
But
there's a sulfate group on it, and now the vomer
nasal organ
very well.
But some of the vomer nasal ligand, like 2-heptanone or something, that one
is not in my hands and several people's hands, a vomer nasal ligand.
Oh, okay. So that's a controversy. yeah. And
but they certainly are male factor.
Sure.
Right.
Unfortunately, we can keep that.
Okay.
Don't forget today, there's a one inch
12.
12.
12 will be good.
Well, very nice.